Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL. Welcome back to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called The Big Move, and it is covering shows that had so much success off-Broadway, they just had to transfer to the Great Wide Way and try some luck over there. My guest today is a friend of the pod, alum of the pod. Some of you know him, and those of you that love him don't know him. He's Dear Good Judy. Please welcome back Robbie Rizel.
What a joy to finally have just us.
Just us, finally.
John who?
So what if it's us? And only us. That's how that goes, right?
Sure.
I'm covering that show at some point. I should probably listen to the score again.
God bless.
Also, we have to remind me to announce when breaks are going to happen.
Yeah.
It was like a month and a half since I recorded the pod, and then we just recorded Love, Valor, Compassion, and I completely forgot to be like, break time, so just Patty.
Doesn't matter, because they won't throw in the commercials at that point anyway, so.
Patty's just going to come in anyway to announce the commercial breaks. Yeah, I'm very proud that I've now made her my break.
I'm sure she'd be thrilled to be your ad queen.
Absolutely. Well, she's no longer a member of Equity. What does she have to complain about?
Precious little.
Robbie, what musicale are we talking about today?
We're talking about Hair, the American tribal love rock musical.
Yes. That is how it was marketed. That is what all the posters said. And that is how literally every review referred to it. Most of them rather eye-rollingly. They were like, ugh, the tribal musical.
Super condescendingly, but it is. That's exactly what it is. So.
It is, yeah. Well, we'll talk about the reviews as we continue talking about the show. The reviews are interesting. Something I will say just up front as we talk about the show is, it is so fascinating to read about this show's trajectory and then to talk to people who saw it on Broadway and then saw the revival and all this stuff. And like the basic theme I get from people is anyone who saw the previous iteration of Hair is less enthused with the next iteration of Hair.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone who saw it at the Public was less enthused with it on Broadway, and then everyone who saw the original Broadway production was less enthused with the revival, and then anyone who saw the revival was less enthused when it came back a year later from the tour.
Right.
So it's always, everyone's just always a little bit, it's not as good as the first time. And I'm like, yes, like losing your virginity. Actually, no, I guess the opposite of losing your virginity. It's usually better after the first time.
Is it?
In my experience.
I don't remember.
Whoever remembers their first time. we all black it out.
Yeah, dreams.
Anywho, Robbie, what is your history with Hair?
What a great question. Thanks for asking.
I do this for a living.
I know. And you make threes of dollars.
I go to the movies once every 2 months because I can afford to now.
Hair first came into my life as a cast album. Mm-hmm. My father listened to a lot of like 70s rock, a lot of like The Who and Rolling Stones and Grand Funk Railroad, all those things. And Hair was sort of in there among that. Mm-hmm. We don't speak, so I never really listened to it. It's getting really good. 3 minutes in. You're welcome. Buckle up, kids.
We love the trauma.
I used to go when I really discovered musicals and cast recordings. I would go and buy like thrift shop ones on vinyl, and Hair was definitely in there. The first time I ever saw part of it was in a high school production. Mm. The high school did scenes from four musicals, and they were get ready, West Side Story, Oklahoma, A Chorus Line, and Hair. And that is, and it was in like Redneck, Pennsylvania. That was a choices were made left and right, strong and wrong.
I mean, although I appreciate a high school that wants to embrace the culture.
That high school really said, what if we just did all public theater shows?
Yeah. all public theater shows and Oklahoma.
And Oklahoma. And so then I was like, this is incredible. You know, so then I started listening to the album a lot and watched the Milos Forman movie. Milos
Forman, yeah.
Him.
That douche.
God bless. He tried.
Yes.
We'll get to it.
I actually have never seen the movie. I've only seen clips of the movie.
You've just seen Mrs. Garrett?
I've seen Aquarius. I've seen Manchester, England. I've seen The White Boys, Black Boys. I've seen Walking Through Space. And I've seen The End, how it ends.
Yes. And then I was in a production of Hair at SUNY Cortland. I did not go to SUNY Cortland, but I was cast. I was Walter. I did not sing Aquarius or What a Piece of Work Is Man. I sang in Ain't Got No.
In my mind, I have this vision of you with like your spidey senses tingling that a musical is happening somewhere and there's someone ill-equipped for a role.
Yeah.
And you walked in and you said, I know I don't go here, but you don't understand. You need me in your musical if it's going to stay afloat. And the director just looked at you and said, I have a feeling you're right. And just and just brought you in.
The director was actually a friend of mine growing up and had directed a lot of theater in my hometown. Mm-hmm. And she was getting her master's at SUNY Cortland, and when this was pre-Facebook, or almost pre-internet, but not quite, I heard that she was doing Hair, and I said, hey, I want in, and she said, okay, and, like, made space for me, but, I sang in Dead End, you know what I mean? And then I went to the opening night of the revival.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
That must have been a wonderful evening.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. My mother is a huge Hair fan. She saw it when she was a teenage. I believe 14. Something to talk about with the Broadway production. When she was a teenager, I think 13 or 14, she went to see Hair for a birthday party. A girl in her class at Dalton got a group of girls together and they went to go see Hair. Well, this girl's parents were like, they were not hippies themselves, but they were very, children should learn and let's embrace the culture. And also, when they saw it, Hair was the thing to see.
Sure.
It was officially like
a phenom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't even just about, oh, is it appropriate? It was in the zeitgeist.
Sure.
But so my mom had seen it, was obsessed with it, had the cast recording.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, we listened to it a lot. And I knew that there were three CDs. That if my mom picked me up from school and she was in a pissy mood, I knew there were three CDs I could play that would get her in a better mood by like track three.
Go.
One was Laura Nyro, the collected works of Laura Nyro, Stone Soul Picnic, Stony End, and then one was Tina Turner. It has the Can't Stop the Rain, Against My Window. And then the third was the original Broadway cast recording of Hair that includes Melba Moore and Miss Diane Keaton.
That is, yeah, we're going to talk about that cast.
And a lot of fun replacements, too.
Mm-hmm.
But so, I had always known Hair through the original cast recording.
Yeah.
To the point that when the 2004 Actors Fund concert happened.
Yes.
And that CD came out, which I know a lot of people in our, like, circles love.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really get into it. I thought it was kind of oversung. Because I was used to kind of the scratchy voices, sort of just kind of barely getting the notes out. I thought that was a little more authentic. And I've now come to a medium with all that.
Uh-huh.
I can appreciate the beautiful vocals of other versions. I still have some issues with that concert recording. And then I missed it in the park. I think
That's where I wish I had seen it most.
Yeah. I didn't get to see it in the park because of stage door. And then when it transferred, I saw it. I was supposed to see it the night before the Tony Awards.
Mm.
And my dumb sister, my bitch sister, who I love very dearly, was graduating from college at Williams, so I had to go to her graduation. And so I went to see Hair a week after that with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a blast. My mom did not.
Oh.
She saw
She saw the original production
exactly
when she was 14.
Yes. And in her mind, she saw the revival. And I was like, I thought they, like, I'm like, they captured the energy. Mm-hmm. Hair is more about a feeling and, you know, vibes than it is about plot, really. So I thought they just were really good at maintaining all that energy. And we walked out, my mom was like, I don't know how to explain it. Just this time they were wearing costumes. And I went, yeah, that's fair. And then her other complaint was, you know, for a show called Hair, there was almost no body hair from any of the men. It was basically Will Swenson standing alone with chest hair, and that was
God bless.
God bless. Everyone else was shaven and waxing.
They had a Merkin budget.
They had a
That's true.
Did they?
Yes.
Why didn't people just grow out? Easier, cheaper.
Unclear. Well, because it was built in, the Merkin budget.
I guess so.
I also fell in love with the music of Hair because So I love not just cast recordings, but like vocal albums of Broadway singers or Broadway adjacent singers.
sure.
And they will often record songs from the show. And sometimes they're excellent. And sometimes they're Andrea McCardle singing Easy to Be Hard.
Yeah.
Or like Sarah Brightman singing Good Morning Starshine, which was a choice.
There are some people who truly can sing anything. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of people, though. Actually, you know what? I wouldn't mind a Kelly O'Hara solo in Walking Through Space, but the way that Melba Moore does it on the OBC, which is all head voice,
yeah,
I don't like it belted.
Or like maybe Frank Mills.
She would do a nice Frank Mills.
Sure.
That, like, it would have to be her Light in the Piazza penis, like, not her Bridges.
Greg would walk in playing the guitar softly, yeah, and she's just singing Frank Mills.
Yeah, like a soft acoustic version. Yeah. But again, I need the Piazza ping, not the Bridges full throat.
Kelly, I know you're listening, and
Kelly, can you hear me?
We've just pitched the... Anyway, Hair.
Yeah, so for anyone who is unaware of Hair... Well, everyone is aware of Hair, but I don't think a lot of people know it well.
Sure.
Which is fair... Because I think a lot of people who've done the show probably don't know it that well.
I would agree.
How would we describe what it's about?
Great question. Because Hair very much is like the chess of its time in that no two versions are alike.
Sure.
I also think that it's like working for hippies because it's very much like a review.
Yeah, it's vignettes.
Yeah. And it's like a dozen I Am songs in Act One.
Yeah.
Where everybody steps forward and sings their, like, central thesis and then sort of recedes. Okay, so Tommy. Hi, I am a professional. Hair.
Ravi makes money being in the industry. Y'all.
Making musical albums.
Yes.
So, but it's now I'm stuck on this Tommy thing and I don't even know why. It's not like a favorite musical of mine. It's just because of that one thing.
Next it. You get out of here, Tommy, and you don't come back.
Tommy, I can't hear you or see you or feel you or I don't know what we're doing with Tommy. All right. So
go back to your
Hair. Essentially is about Claude Hooper Bukowski and a group of friends who are counterculturalist people of the 60s set with the backdrop of the Vietnam War in New York and essentially dodging the draft any way they can. Mm-hmm. There's like love triangles within there. There's like all sorts of stuff. And then at the end, Claude gets drafted and decides he's going. Like he feels that that's his duty, unclear as to why he decides to go when so many people dodged, but goes, gets killed. Everybody sings Let the Sunshine In. That is the nitty-gritty plot.
Yeah. I would say like if there's one major plot thread to Hair, it is Claude.
Yes.
It is him getting drafted and not burning his card and ultimately choosing to go and to Vietnam to fight, and he dies at the end.
Don't you feel that Claude very much is an outsider who's trying to fit in but can't make the leap?
Again, because, as you said, no two versions of Hair are alike. Mm-hmm. It also depends on the actor and what text is used.
Sure.
It's sort of the polar opposite of Chess, though, because whereas Hair has very little plot, Chess just has too much plot.
Too much plot, but like the song stack is... consistently different.
Yeah.
Songs are assigned to different people.
Yeah, different orders.
Uh-huh.
And also, like, Chess, very few skips. Hair is an almost no-skip album for me. I think I can name, like, three songs that I don't care for.
There's also like 115 albums of Hair.
Yeah. Well, Hair, I think, was the first Broadway musical to have multiple non-English speaking cast recordings, like, so close to the original album coming out.
Yeah.
Because it took time for a long. Because the way that the cast album history begins, right, is with Oklahoma. There was no original Broadway cast recording before Oklahoma. It was like highlights sometimes and singers, as you said, popular singers would cover stuff.
Right.
And then Oklahoma was the first time of like capturing the cast and the feel from the theater.
And the orchestra.
Yeah, exactly. And then selling it. And then that sort of progressed. And then Hair was sort of, I mean, I don't want
to. So let's give a history of Hair.
Yeah.
Because it started downtown.
Yes. Well, so Hair was written by James Rado and Jerome Ragney. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I guess I say both their names. With music by Galt McDermott.
Right. And all three were on stage opening night of the Broadway production.
Yes. Rado and Ragney were actors who met doing an off-Broadway play called Hang Down Your Head and Die in 1964, which I believe closed on opening night.
Yep. It was the glory day of its time.
Yes. Rado was a bit more of a successful actor than Ragney. He had done a few Broadway shows off-Broadway. Ragney's only Broadway credit was as, like, a knight when Richard Burton did Hamlet. And the idea they got for Hair was essentially from their own lives and their friends and their own personal friendship. Like, the friendship of Claude and Berger, who they played in the original production, was very much their own friendship. Just, like, very passionate and tumultuous and, like, a little toxic. Which I give them credit for, like, having the objectivity to recognize that and putting it in the show. And they had been reading these articles about how kids were getting kicked out of school for having their hair too long.
Sure.
That was the point of America, where boys would start growing their hair long and they would get kicked out because it wasn't at the right length. So they found inspiration from that, and then they got the title from a painting by Jim Dine that was also called Hair, and that was literally just a tuft of hair. They saw it, they saw the painting, and they saw the title, and they're like, I think that's the title of our show. And they knew it was going to be a musical, they knew it was going to be vignettes, and it was also going to be sort of about the war, because the Vietnam War had begun by the mid-60s, and they wanted to sort of be in response to that, and they would send out their material to multiple producers, and the story differs based on who you ask. Ragney,
always.
Rado and Ragney are like, we had a typed up manuscript. We don't know what anyone's talking about. Like, we sent out, like, full scripts to people. And then their producers were like, I got, like, Chinese food receipts with, like, lyrics on the back of it. They, like, everyone has different stories. And I'm sure it's all true.
What's weird is I was just at Panda Express before I got here. And Aquarius was actually on the back of my receipt.
Go fig.
So, handwritten.
Yeah. Well, the also the other thing is, I was telling someone yesterday as I was continuing my research, like, oh, how's the Hair research going? I'm like, half the things I read are just like, I don't, like, who came up with this idea? I don't know. We were all high, man. But what I will give them credit for is Ragney was really, he was a, the term we like to use sometimes in the theater world is shark. He was a shark about getting the material out there and getting somebody to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew Joseph Papp a bit. And Papp at this point was just, had been just doing the Shakespeare in the Park. The public theater had not existed yet, but he had gotten a grant for the public theater because Shakespeare in the Park was so successful. And they were in the middle of construction for it. They went, they had the
library. Down on Lafayette.
Yes, yeah. Down on Lafayette. Was the Morgan Library? No, the Astor Library, that they were renovating to become the public theater.
Yeah.
And it was still under renovation when Papp got the material for Hair. And what I will say from the Papp oral history biography and the oral history of the public theater is everyone admits Joseph Papp had amazing taste. He didn't know jack shit about musicals. And Hair kind of ruined his thinking as an artistic director for the public afterwards. And we'll get to that in a second. Because Hair was the first show done at the public.
Right.
First musical, first show ever.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it came about was he got the material and he was like, you know, this looks pretty good. And he, like, showed it to his wife. And his wife's like, this doesn't mean, like, this makes no sense.
Yeah.
And the lyrics are like, hair, 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 hair. Well, and
I mean, the lyrics are... Cole Porter wishes he wrote this many list songs.
Truly.
Yeah.
So many lists. And half of the songs we know from Hair weren't in the public production. And
right.
had a very different ending. Let the Sunshine In was not in the original version. And basically, Papp told the writers, get yourself... No, so he got the resident director or somebody who was going to be the resident director for the public enlisted him to be the director for this. His name was Gerald Friedman. And Friedman read the material and he was like, okay, they need a composer because the music they had was like,
you can die in bed. You can live in bed. Quack-a-tick-a-tread. That's
nothing ever happens in Blaine. It was very that.
Just home for Purim.
Imagine if Aquarius was the music to Nothing Happens in Blaine.
Perfect.
When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars. But so they were like, you get yourself a real composer. And I don't know how McDermott was the one they picked. He was a Grammy winner at that point because someone had covered one of his songs.
Yeah.
But he wasn't.
I don't know how they met. Yeah. But
they did.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Honestly, because the music is what really stands up.
1,000%.
And makes you sit up. Like, just from the opening of the album, the minute you put the needle down on the record, yes, kids, or you hit play on Spotify, like, it grabs
you.
You
say, Alexa, play.
Right now, everybody do it. Alexa, play Aquarius from Hair.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
Which album? But, you know, that's, and what's so crazy is, like, Ragni and Radar were of that movement.
Yeah.
McDermott was not.
Not at all. He was in a suit. So I read Laurie Davis's book, Letting Down My Hair, for this pod. Mm-hmm. And she was in the original cast. She sang White Boys. She was not Melba Moore.
No.
and the...
But she plays Abraham Lincoln.
Though, yes.
So
uh-huh.
Yes, yes, yes.
So she... the book was written... not long after she had left the show and was very unhappy because, the building of the show was it for the cast.
Yeah.
And then the doing of the show was not. It was a lot like Hamilton in that regard. Like, the cast was happy until they weren't. And so there's, like, a bitter tinge to the book. However, she loved the composer and... said that he was sort of just always smiling, always, and always in a suit.
Yeah. And he had a wife and four kids. He had four kids. He was also pushing 40 at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, Ragni and Rado also were over 30 at this point.
100%.
And there was a lot of controversy because they both wanted to be in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were doing it at the public, Friedman was like, absolutely not. You're both too old. And then he eventually acquiesced and let Ragni play Berger, but he wouldn't let Rado play Claude because he was like, it's so important that Claude come off as young. And James Rado was 33.
And with a receding hairline.
Yeah. Looked 40.
Yeah.
I'm about to turn 33. I look like I could be James Rado's son in the photos of James Rado. Like, he does not look like he's 33.
He definitely was trying to be the Derek Klena of his day, still playing high schoolers into his 40s.
There's a video of Rado and Ragni singing, I think it's Hair, on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, like, they look 45, even though they're a solid 10 years younger than that. But they look 45, especially because everyone else in the cast is 18 to 24.
Yeah.
So they stuck out like a sore thumb. And basically off-Broadway at the public, it was just kind of... a total mess because every day Rado and Ragni would come in being like, oh, we found this thing that we wanted to include. And we're in Tompkins Square Park and we want to include this. And there was no script. And basically Friedman had to create a show from nothing. And everyone in the cast nobody was an actor really. A couple people were like singers like Melba Moore.
Right.
But most people were just sort of people that they had found. And everyone was high all the time. They tell a story about how Paul Jabara, who would sing It's My Conviction, and then went on to write Last Dance and Rachel Lilley.
Really? Yeah, the important thing.
The important thing. And then wrote a bunch of stuff for Fame, too, Paul Jabara, I believe, maybe?
No.
No?
No.
He became a pop record producer.
Yeah, right now, but
I feel like he wrote some more.
He was writing another musical that never got produced as well.
Yeah. But he was like 17, 18 when they did it in the public. And Friedman tells a story in the public Pap book about... how, like, one rehearsal, he just was, like, so fucking zonked that Friedman, like, pushed him up against a wall and said, if you come in tomorrow stoned, you're fired. Because, they couldn't do anything.
Right.
And, again, Rado wanted to play Claude and kept undermining Friedman. They brought in a choreographer and everyone was fighting. Friedman left a week before performances were supposed to start. He's like, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, Rado fired the actor playing Claude and played Claude. The choreographer took over. All the changes that Friedman made to the script were reversed, and they played the first performance. It was a disaster. Joe Papp called up Friedman. He's like, please come back.
Mm-hmm.
Friedman comes back, and he's like, okay, I've got two performances to get this back to where I was. And he said, the first performance, we did my first act and their second act. I fired Rado, had the young guy play Claude again. And then the second performance, we did both of my acts, and then we opened the third performance, and we got good reviews and sold out. And the problem was that because it was sold out and was already becoming a movement, there was pressure from Joe Papp to extend it or just, like, have it keep playing.
And mm-hmm.
the Ann Pascher Theater, how do you say that name?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the theater where Passing Strange was in.
Correct.
Runaways.
Suffs. No.
No, Suffs was in.
Where Fat Ham just played.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I also saw Bright Room Called Day in there.
See What I Want to See.
See What I Want to See. First Daughter Suite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I did that cast album. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
Well, I'm a giver.
It's like a 250-seat theater. It's uh-huh. like a thrust space.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, and they made it very environmental and whatnot in that theater, and it was a big, big hit. Like, it caught on immediately. And
Joe Papp was convinced that you couldn't move it to a proscenium.
Yes, and also convinced that it was... Joe Papp also had a disdain for Broadway and commercial theater.
Sure.
He didn't want it to move. He thought that was not artistic, and... He has said in retrospect that was wrong. He said what he would have done was he just would have kept it open and used that money for other stuff. But he's like, I had Hamlet coming in the spring. I couldn't have Hair playing. So, and they only had like two theaters at the time at the Public. So it was like, it couldn't go anywhere. And so a man by the name of Michael Butler, mm-hmm. who was a Chicago businessman and had run for state Senate in Illinois and worked for JFK's campaign at one point. He had seen the show on a whim because he had seen the poster and thought – he was also a big Native American rights activist.
Yes, very much. And that original poster had three actors. It was like a black and white shot or sort of like a silver tone shot of the three of them. And they are in like Native headdress and stuff.
Yeah. And he was so convinced that the show was about Native American rights that he went to go see it. And – it was not about that,
nope.
But he loved it anyway mm-hmm. and saw it like six more times. And he called up Joe Papp about wanting to do something with it because he realized that it was a limited run. It wasn't going to go anywhere. And basically Papp was like, I don't want to have anything to do with that. He's like, if you can raise the money, move it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had two options. They could make it go to the Henry Miller Theater, which is now the Stephen Sondheim, or they could take it to like some random space that was not for Broadway.
Right.
So they went to a discotheque called the Cheetah.
The Cheetah. And I don't know what you do with the Cheetah, but I know it's not dancing.
Nope. it is a very... Have you, like, read about the whole Cheetah experience?
No.
Okay. And not Rivera, everybody. It is. It was a discotheque in the West 50s. And apparently a really large space that had a giant platform that I guess used to be for, like, singers or dancers.
I feel like Rocky Horror played there as well at one point.
It might have.
Yeah.
Much later, but yeah, mm-hmm. it might have. But the thinking was people would go to the Cheetah, we know, pay their price of admission, and I think like they upped the price of admission by $1, and that dollar would cover the running costs of the cast of Hair. Because you would go and you would dance, and then the show would begin. And it's like, oh, we have like a free show, and you would think, like, I have a free show. And
wild.
Yeah. And it was this, it had this big platform and you know, whatnot. And they basically just, they did the show as they did it at the Public, reconfigured it a bit and made it interactive, and no one gave two shits about it.
Right. Because imagine you're going to, for a night out, mm-hmm. you're going to a disco, and suddenly there's a full-ass play happening in front of you of whether or not you should burn your draft card.
Yeah.
Would you care?
No.
Because that's not what you signed up for.
And again, this version of Hair was not the version that we know and love. Like, it ended with, and again, it's so fascinating. If you read the book The Season by William Goldman, he talks about how when it got to Broadway, it became too sanitized and commercial pleasing because the original ending of Hair had these like toy army tanks
mm-hmm.
that fought each other and blew each other up. There was no song. It just ended like that. And he was like, it was this beautiful metaphor for the sort of stupidity of war, because we're basically these grown people playing with toys, and what does any of it mean? It's like, and now on Broadway it ends with this big feel good song, and which we all know is the iconic "Let the Sunshine In."
Right.
But so, like, imagine going to a discotheque and, like, Aquarius begins and you're like, oh, she's a bop. But then 2 hours later and it ends with these toy trucks and you're like, I just want to dance.
Right.
This version of Hair lasted for all of 6 weeks and completely bombed. And so then what happened was Michael Butler called up Joseph Papp and he said, hey, can I buy the stage rights from you? Because I would like to move to Broadway. And Joseph Papp was like, sure, you bombed at the Cheetah, you're going to bomb off Broadway, go for it. Sold him the rights. And literally it was the worst mistake of Joe Papp's career.
Uh-huh.
And everyone says, this is why I bring it back up to the why Hair influenced Joe Papp forever. Everyone who was on the board of the Public during Joe Papp's reign said him selling the rights and Hair becoming what it was, because the Public got like a minor percentage.
I was going to ask you if they got
got something.
Anything. They it's not something. Like Chorus Line.
No, not Chorus Line, Hamilton stuff. Like, no, they got something, but a very minor.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, all Broadway transfers from the Public from there on out, like, the negotiations were intense because Pat made sure that the Public got something from it. But everyone said after that, Papp's view of what to pick for seasons at the Public changed forever, because then he was like, is this something that could transfer, which was never something he thought about before. So, like, with Two Gentlemen of Verona, also with Galt McDermott, he let them develop because he thought to himself, this could be another Hair, this could be another crowd pleaser. And it was a crowd pleaser. It was not the institution that Hair was, obviously.
Certainly won a Tony.
It won a Tony over Follies. Uh-huh. Everyone loves to talk about that, but it ran for almost 2 years. It toured and made the money. But, like, a lot of people, when it transferred from the Delacorte, were like, why? Like, this was so nice. Like, let it be. And he was like, no. He's like, it can transfer. And this, and it was, you know, 2 years after Hair, so it tells you something. And a lot of other things that were at the Public transferred in the 70s. Chorus Line, obviously, that championship season. Plenty was in the 80s. But, like, everyone talks about how – and Pirates of Penzance and Mystery of Edward Drood.
Yeah.
People talk about how, like, Papp was so gung-ho about moving Drood, even though no one thought it was Broadway ready.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of his mentality of, like, what can go to Broadway? What can go to Broadway?
Right. What's going
to
pay for things?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which, like Chorus Line did. But Butler bought the rights and had 3 months to overhaul Hair. So he fired Friedman, the original director. He brought on Tom O'Horgan, who at that point was only known for downtown experimental work at La Mama. And they fired the original design team, which included Ming Cho Lee, which I would love to have known what that set looked like.
Truly, yeah. And brought on Robin Wagner.
Yeah, which was one of his first Broadway gigs, I think. Uh-huh. Yeah. Fione V. Aldridge was the costume designer. No, she was the original costume designer. I don't know who did the costumes for Broadway. And had a majority new cast, a couple people from off-Broadway, Melba Moore, Shelley Plimpton, Paul Jabara, Jerome Ragney was Berger again, but Jill O'Hara, the original Sheila. Jill O'Hara, the original Sheila, was replaced by Lynn Kellogg.
Yep, of the Kellogg fortune.
Seriously?
Yeah, she's the daughter of...
God bless.
Uh-huh.
And we bring in Diane Keaton.
Mm-hmm. Shelley Plimpton, who is Martha's mother.
Yep. The completely overhauled. Yep. Dozen new songs, made it much... And cut down a lot of the book, made it much more just truly vignettes.
Yeah.
And everyone who saw Hair on Broadway after seeing it off Broadway were underwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Everyone but Clive Barnes, who was just so happy we had a rock musical.
Yeah.
But everybody else was like, ah, oh, the magic is gone. The authenticity is gone. But we will discuss that in a second, because Robbie, I think it's time we take a break.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top.
And we're back. Do you know, Robbie, what the musical's Hair was up against for at the Tonys that year?
I do know that it was up against 1776, which won.
Yes.
Oh, God, what were the other musicals that year, 69?
Speaking of Jill O'Hara.
Oh, Promises, Promises, of course. Of course.
Of course. And then A Candor and Ebb musicale.
The Happy Time?
No. A little later than that.
Oh, fuck. No, I don't.
Life is what you do.
Until you're dead. Yeah. Zorba.
Zorba.
Right, of course, because watching the Tony performance of this, and at the end, like, Zero Mostel comes out, and there's, like, the massive thing of marquees, and Zorba's up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zorba opened the telecast, and Hair closed out the telecast.
9 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, they got a long performance. Yeah.
And wow, they could never do that number on the Tonys now.
Nope. They
did 3500 among other things. Yeah.
And then they went into
Let
the Sunshine In. But
Blood, A Piece of Work is Man is in there too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And at that point, what's her name? She was in falsettos originally. She played the doctor.
Janet Metz or no. Heather McRae?
Heather McRae.
Yeah, huh?
Heather McRae was
Gordon's daughter.
Yes. Sheila McRae was Heather McRae was the Sheila that performed on the Tonys that year.
So I want to know when What a Piece of Work is Man became Two Women.
I'm not sure.
Because it is not written that way.
No.
And it's Hair is one of those shows where anybody who's not a principal, the character is named after the original cast member. So you're like, I'm Walter. And it's just like a guy whose name was Walter. And like Smokey Joe's Cafe is the same way, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it makes no sense or purpose.
Purpose?
It's just, I barely know her. It just makes no, it was an odd, it was gorgeous, gorgeously sung. And Melba Moore gave it. She ate, as the kids say.
That, and Melba Moore eats that album. My God, are her vocals.
She's doing the heavy lifting of all the vocals.
1,000%.
Yeah.
So again, that kind of goes into, everyone was like, so high, and everyone takes credit for everything. So like Friedman takes credit for making the show make any kind of sense, and then Horgan takes a lot of credit for making it more like Broadway ready and theatrical. But then cast members will take credit for different ideas, and you know, Ragni and Rado were always coming in with new text, and McDermott had to come up with new music on the spot. And so there's no real paper trail of who did what or what became what. Melba Moore says has a quote in the book I have here, which is Broadway Musicals, the 101 Greatest Broadway Musicals.
Revised and updated.
Yup. Her quote is, on a show like Hair, you were considered professional if you showed up.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you showed up and who knows what happened on the day. During the be-in and then during walking through space, everyone's supposed to be smoking pot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to be stage pot because you can't be high when you're doing a show. But Melba talked about how, like, there were nights where someone was passing on real weed and you didn't know until you got to Let the Sunshine In. And you're, like, doing Let the Sunshine In and you're like, fuck, I'm flipping out.
So high.
And she's, like, got a belt and ash. She's like, motherfucker.
And Michael Butler was bringing in Dr. Feelgood to shoot them up before the show every night.
Yep. So we were mentioning this before. A lot of people in the original production of Hair
were high
and also didn't have a lot of nice things to say about the experience.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned, baby Diane Keaton was in it, and she was pretty miserable most of the show.
And what I've read is she was the best Sheila that there ever was.
Yes, she was. So she was the second Sheila. Lynn Kellogg was the first.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
but then she's like, I gotta go make cornflakes.
Yeah, she was in it for 3 months.
Right.
And then pieced the fuck out. The show opened in April, and that's another thing, by the way. So the show opened in April of 68, but was up for the 69 Tonys. And what happened was the Tony cutoff was supposed to be, it used to be, I guess, like, it didn't have to necessarily be opening night. You just had to start performances before the cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
And Hair had 2 weeks of previews on Broadway, and they started previews a week before the cutoff.
Yeah.
So they were supposed to be eligible. And then what happened was CBS or NBC, whichever TV station was going to air the show, pressured the Tony committee to move up the deadline a month. So it was March. So Michael Butler for Hair and I think another show sued because they were like misled or whatever.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And the case got thrown out. So they ended up just being eligible for the following year. And then if you watch the Tonys that year, no one in the audience takes Hair seriously. Like, Carol Burnett's listing off the nominees early in the telecast.
Uh-huh.
She's like, we've got 4 musicals up this year. We got Zorba and 1776 and Hair. And everyone starts to laugh. It's like, can you believe Hair is up for best musical? And I'm like, I'm sorry. Hair is the cultural phenomenon that is making these ratings go through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason you put it at the end of the telecast so people would stay tuned in.
It is fascinating, too, that in that telecast, when you watch them perform that number and it goes to a wide shot and you just see head after head after head of audience members just stuck.
Yeah. So, who, like, not
as,
wanting to be there.
As these people are, like, truly, like, belting to bleed. It's fascinating to see, like, culture and counterculture coexist. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to make a point and not well.
Well, actually, so this reminds me, this isn't hair specific, but hair is related to it. If anyone who watches the Tony Awards, if you haven't watched early ceremonies, and I'm talking like pre-2000, before Radio City Music Hall, really.
So before Rosie, which would be 96.
Yeah, well, so like the first three or four telecasts of Radio City Music Hall kind of have this energy, but it gets lost pretty soon. But when it used to be in a Broadway theater,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't just sell tickets to anybody, right. It was really just like the nominees,
mm-hmm.
people immediately involved in the show, and like the community.
Right.
You got a really good sense of what shows the community was behind.
Mm-hmm.
Based on like when they would do their performance, like who, like what the entrance applause was for the performance, when the nominees were listed, and then whoever won. So like when Dorothy Loudon wins for Annie, everyone flips the fuck out.
Yeah, because like goes she, crazy.
Yeah, when Tyne Daly wins for Gypsy, everyone freaks out. When Elizabeth Taylor comes on to give Best Musical to 42nd Street, and the audience won't let her begin talking because they're just so, everyone's so in love with her.
Sure.
And then she's like also fucking up left and right. I love it so much.
She's also probably as high as the people in hair.
Oh yeah, it's
allegedly.
It's wonderful. I just love it. I just she's giggling the entire time, but it's great. And uh-huh. she's like, she's flippantly telling the mezzanine to stop it. Like they're right up next to her, like a friend.
Because
they keep cheering. She's like, stop it. It's so great. But it's the same thing. Like, you know, when Chorus Line was up that year, and you know, every mm-hmm. time Chorus Line wins, everyone goes insane.
Yeah.
And so for that year with hair, you can tell that like, everyone in the theater is a little resentful that it's so successful because I don't think anyone in the theater that year is, like, pleased with it because they're more – everyone was actually really more behind Promises that year than anything else. If you listen to the
Which
applause.
Is so fascinating because that's not what won.
No. 1776 wins.
Right.
And from the sound of the applause, no one's upset by it. But Promises was sort of like the middle ground of – it had a sound similar to hair. It was new. It mm-hmm. was modern, but it was still yeah. a traditional musical with storytelling and involved people who the community respected, like Neil Simon and Michael Bennett and Roger Moore, I think was his name. No, not Roger Moore. Robert Moore.
Yeah.
That was the director.
I was like, Roger Moore.
007 directing.
Sure. Promise. Why not? Honestly.
And boys in the band.
Turkey lurkey damn time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the 1776 won because it was so America versus hair, mm-hmm. which those same voters would think of as un-American? And I'm using big
yeah.
hand quotes for listeners.
I don't know. So I really do think with hair, it just comes down to nobody respected it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it got nominated for musical and director almost begrudgingly. If, you know, if Dear World were better,
sure.
Dear World probably would have been the fourth nominee, not mm-hmm. Hair. But, because 1776, it's pro-America, but it's also questioning. The way I kind of describe 1776 is it's very much a product of its time and how it views the founding fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's sort of, you know, what kind of country are we? What do we want to become?
Right.
It's pre-Watergate, but mid-Vietnam War.
Yep.
So it's not totally cynical of government, but it is a little. It's
certainly cynical of war in Mama Look Sharp.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But in a way that's
not in this production that's closing.
we don't talk about Bruno. But
no.
It pushes the buttons very lightly, where it's more sort of like we're just asking the question. Mm-hmm. We're not blaming you, we're not making
it's not an indictment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more just sort of like, hey, can we like discuss this? And whereas Promises is like, look how like evolved we're becoming, like with our mini skirts and our go-go music. And then hair is just sort of like, no, it's all a mess and
right.
we don't have the answers, but we blame you anyway.
Yeah.
This is my doom, my humiliation. October, not June. And it's summer vacation. Disgrace. How can I face the nation? Why should this pain bring me such strain? D-O-L-A-O.
It's everything that the people who are in those tuxedos do not enjoy.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. And so did they vote for 1776 because that is what they see as their version of progress?
I think the voters probably voted for 1776 for a number of reasons. One is the progress. One is that it is legit a good musical.
Yeah.
And also 1776, I think, came later in the season. Mm-hmm. I think the order goes Hair, Zorba, Promises, 1776.
Yeah.
So that had the benefit of being newer.
Sure.
Everyone fresh in everybody's minds. And also it had the element of surprise because everyone thought that thing was going to bomb.
Mm-hmm.
The joke with 1776 is, why go see it? You know how it's going to end.
Right.
And then the magic of that show is like, you get to the middle of it and you're like, I'm not so sure how it's going to end.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. Is it going to, are they going to sign it? Like, we're getting close to the end and they haven't signed it yet.
Peter Stone, you wrote a great book.
He wrote a great book.
Uh-huh.
So it's a lot of that. And I think with the Americana stuff, it was the right amount of indictment, not too forward thinking, but just enough. Hair, I really do think, just comes down to no one took it seriously.
So Tom O'Horgan takes over, mm-hmm. and he's slashing things left and right, and they recast, etc.
bring the writers back in as the leads.
Yes. Wig them.
Yeah, wig them hard.
Did you know that the show on Broadway opened with Claude sitting cross-legged on the lip of the stage? When the doors opened to the theater, mm-hmm. he was sitting there. And some cast members were, wandering the audience and, mm-hmm. Interacting, etc. And then somebody brings in a grill. I literally just read about this because I had no idea. And I've been in the show. that somebody brings in, a burning grill. And there's, a music beat. And a burger comes in, cuts a piece of Claude's hair, puts it into the grill, and lights it on fire. And that is how Hair begins. Your eyes tell me that you did not know that to be true.
I did not know that to be true.
So again, Laurie Davis's book, Letting Down My Hair, chapter 18, spells out beat by beat everything that happened in the show.
Yeah.
It is far better than any Wikipedia synopsis ever could be. But I was just agog by that symbolism, especially because they'll use that grill later to burn draft cards, mm-hmm. etc. It's so fascinating to me.
That is fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I read about sort of the original staging of things that went down with it that I'm like, cool, but why? So mm-hmm. With White Boy, White Boys, Melba Moore singing lead, of course.
Yeah.
It was inspired by Diana Ross and the Supremes.
Sure.
And then what happened was that as they sang and they started to spread out, you realize that they weren't wearing separate dresses.
They were all in one dress.
One big red dress, sparkly mm-hmm. red dress, on top of a, I don't want to call it a platform, but
it was like a floating, because apparently they had to add a bar to it, mm-hmm. Because it was made out of mesh. Mm-hmm. And so originally they were supposed to be in high heels. Again, Laurie Davis's book, shout out. So glad I bought it for $3.
That's as much as I'm going to make for this episode.
Correct. You're welcome. I'm glad I told you to take an ad break.
we got to take another one eventually.
It was like fucking chicken wire, whatever, right? And so the heels were getting caught in it, and one wrong move and they all go over because it's one dress. They add a bar to they had added plastic to the bottom, but then they were just slipping, so they nixed the heels altogether. Mm-hmm. Gone. Plastic stayed over the mesh, mm-hmm. but added a bar to hold on to, because they were flown out basically, mm-hmm. and they had no safety
whatsoever. That's again the 60s and Hair. And Miss Keaton, Oscar winner Diane Keaton, was mm-hmm. the soloist for Black Boys, you can hear on the cast album.
Yeah.
And those three women are dressed sort of I don't know, how would you describe it? In stereotypical getup for black, with Afro wigs and things like that.
Yeah. What's fascinating, I watched for the first time today the Encores production, mm-hmm. Which is on YouTubes.
It is on the YouTubes.
And I did not enjoy it.
No, it's messy, which ironically, it's ironic. It got good reviews and was rumored to go to Broadway.
Yeah. Well, but there were only four critics.
Yes, but it part of the reason why it was rumored to go to Broadway is because it sold so well.
Idina Menzel.
She wasn't really famous at that point.
She had come off of Wicked.
No, she hadn't.
A Wicked hadn't happened yet.
This was 2001. Fuck. This was May of 2001. Right. So she had Rent under her belt.
That's it.
And she had come off of Wild Party and Aida. That was it. So she was like, she was...
You're right.
There were some cool people on that show, though. Gavin Creel was in the ensemble.
Uh-huh.
Miriam Shore was doing Air. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, she was great.
She was great.
Luther Creek and Tom Plotkin are the two leads.
Yes.
Two names you do not hear anymore.
No, Plotkin was Willard in Footloose. That was his big one.
Yes. And he was one of the Wickersham brothers.
Excuse a girl, yes. And Kathleen Marshall did the production of Hair at Encores.
It's way too danced.
Way too danced. And, like, doesn't have any kind of flow. It's very stop-starty.
Yeah.
And... I truly think the reason why anyone was interested in it moving was, A, Hair had not been on Broadway for over 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of excitement about seeing it again,
right.
And because it did sell out the entire run.
Sure.
And they're like, oh, there's money to be had, but then they're like, you know, now that we're looking at it, this production really wasn't that special.
No.
And the reason why Hair did come back to Broadway was because Diane Paulus was able to make something of it in the park, and then was actually able to make it even more of something when it moved to Broadway. I remember when they announced it was going to Broadway, the thinking everyone had was, because, you know, when things transfer, we all imagine it's just going to be exactly like it was, and no one's going to reconfigure it for the new space.
Right.
So everyone's like, oh, they're just going to put AstroTurf on the Hirschfeld stage and call it a day. That's going to look lame. And then when everyone went into the theater and there was like a truck on stage and carpets and all that stuff, I was like, oh, the rethought. I'm like, yeah, like when they put Fun Home in the round, and it's like, oh, it's not the same design.
The original production had a truck on stage for the band. Yeah,
that's fun. I didn't know that. Yeah,
and the composer played piano in that in the original pit. As I said, they were all on stage on opening night.
Twer.
So opening
night of Hair.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's April 29th of 1968 at the Biltmore, now the Samuel Friedman, that Manhattan Theater Club owns.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. So anytime you go see a play at the Friedman, if you saw Cost of Living, or if you go to see The Collaboration, or if you saw, you know, Little Foxes with Laura Linney. And
sure did.
Yep. I did too.
In just the correct.
Just know, that's where Diane Keaton sang Easy to Be Hard. And eventually Melba Moore.
Especially people.
So if you do read The Season by William Goldman, which is like the bitchiest of books, I love it.
It really is.
He's so bitchy. He talks about Hair, you know, it's very like, ugh, the Broadway version, whatever. It was all about when it was downtown. Fuck that. And one thing he talks about, because I guess they didn't do it. They didn't do it for off-Broadway. There was no nudity off-Broadway.
Right.
That was added for Broadway.
Correct.
And everyone assumes that it was a publicity stunt. And what it really was Ragni and Rado had gone to a protest in Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
And men were taking off their clothes in protest.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what statement that makes, but whatever. I'm not bound by corporations and their clothes, man.
Get these Levi's off of me.
No. I'll prove that nothing comes between me and my Calvins. But so, Ragni and Rado come into rehearsal and they're like, nudity.
Yeah.
Done. We want to do it.
So they discussed it once, and then it was never talked about again. And then in the first preview, three of them just stood up naked during that number.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other cast members were like, what's happening right now?
Yeah.
Because they never discussed it. And then slowly more and more of them, because it was always optional.
Yeah.
The
word is that eventually producers started offering cast members more money if they
did $1.50.
Yep. And some cast members said, there's one person who's quoted in the PAP book. She was like, I will do it for free because getting naked for that little money makes me feel like a whore.
Yeah. That's probably Lori Davis, actually.
Probably. Probably. And not everyone did it. Keaton never did it.
Right. She did it years later, and something's got to give.
Sure did. Her only nude scene. But she suffered from bulimia at that time, and so had major body dysmorphia. So, like, I'm sure in her mind, if we are similar in any way, she's thinking to herself, no one wants to see my naked body, and I'm not comfortable with it anyway. And you look at Diane Keaton at that time, I'm like, girl, they would have lined up around the block to see
truly
naked. You are stunning.
But also, it's fascinating that she was in hair and is probably the most covered up human in all of Hollywood.
1000%. Like, always turtlenecks,
gloves, hats, yep. Turtleneck, like, ever. She's just eyes.
She doesn't wear, yeah, eyes and eyes and teeth. She doesn't wear, she doesn't show skin ever.
No,
but she was in hair for almost a year and then peaced out, I think, around like January of 69 to do Play It Again, Sam. Which ended up being a great career move because she got, yep, a Tony nomination that same year. The year The Hair was nominated, she had got a Tony nomination herself for that play, got to be in the movie version of that play, and that also got her The Godfather. And the rest is Oscar-winning history.
And also, like, Play It Again, Sam was Woody Allen, which, yeah, started, like, a long
collaboration for, yeah, her. Yeah, that was a good career move for her. She got to make, mm-hmm, a lot of movies because of that.
Yeah.
But... yeah, Hair, like, so Hair ended up running the longest of any of those shows that season.
Yeah.
Runs for 4.5 years, major cultural moment, has multiple national tours, sit-down productions in Chicago, goes to London immediately.
They're celebrating it with huge concerts. Mm-hmm. They did, 1 year they did a huge concert on the Central Park Mall. Mm-hmm. 1 year, I sent you the album of it, they did a full-ass mass at St. John the Divine, where the offertory, again, is 3500. Mm. And that's, how you say, choice.
Choice. It's all choices.
But they're doing, like, songs from Hair and also a mass that he has composed. And it's a full-ass service that you can go to Spotify and listen to. It's called Divine Hair. It spawned so many different albums of, like, cut songs. There's a whole album called Disinherited, mm-hmm, that are cut songs from Hair by that cast. London had two cast albums originally. Elaine Page is in one of them. She was in,
yeah, she's
cast
in
B.
Sure was. Pre Evita.
Uh-huh. It went everywhere.
Yeah. That, if you ever read articles about Elaine Page's casting as Eva Perón in, like, 77... the thing that everyone likes to say, we're like, she's not, she's like, she's not inexperienced. She was in Hair, but they don't list her as, you know, like, an obvious choice.
Right.
They're like, you know, she was in Hair. She did a show, but, like, it's Hair. Who even knows? Who even knows?
Exactly.
Yeah. But the thing about Hair that's so interesting is it's one of those Broadway musicals like Fiddler, mm-hmm, where it was successful everywhere it went.
Yes.
Which is interesting considering it feels so American.
Mm-hmm.
But I think because, A, the music is...
A bop.
And the vibes of Hair are relatable all over the world.
Yes.
Even if it's very specific to its American attributes. But it's the same thing with Fiddler. Like, Fiddler is so specific to Russia of that era,
mm-hmm,
but its themes are so universal that it plays everywhere. I mean, the famous story goes when they
Japanese.
Did it...
Japanese. Yeah,
when they went to Japan, and they asked the creators on opening night, does America get this show?
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, I love it.
What I said to you off mic, and I'm going to repeat it here
for the pod.
All three people listening right now.
How dare you?
Listen.
My listenership is solid, okay?
Some of these episodes are just shy of being an audiobook.
Yeah, yeah. and what?
Nothing. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah.
What really is great about it is the music is so malleable, mm-hmm, that you can almost do anything to it and not kill it. It's like much like casting Chicago. Mm. You can almost do anything,
yeah,
and it works. I agree, too, that newer albums that are, like, prettier, mm-hmm, or, like, better sung and cleaner, I prefer the grit,
yeah,
of that original album to any of them.
I'll always prefer the Melbourne Moore White Boys to anything.
And sure.
Like, and it's not even the most, the arrangements aren't even that extraordinary. It's just, it's the energy, it's the authenticity of it.
There's also 8 musicians, mm-hmm, on that album that sound like 50. They sound so huge, and a lot of that is the orchestration, specifically the use of trumpet,
mm-hmm,
which is such an interesting instrument to use for this show.
A rock musical.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they use 2. it's not just a trumpet.
Yeah.
They have a section.
It's, oh my God. I mean, the original orchestrations and arrangements,
mm-hmm.
again, I just said, like, not that exceptional for White Boys, and I mean that, but, like, it's still so inventive and,
yeah.
and wonderful and creative. Just the way that it all comes together, because so many times the original vocal arrangements are so simple,
yeah,
but they're so effective. Yeah, my God.
I'm trying to look up and see who wrote the orchestrations, and I wonder if, like, the band just created them.
It's entirely possible. Again,
because it's not credited.
Again, one of those things where it's like, I don't know, man, we were all high.
The album won the Grammy.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Rightfully so.
Can we talk about some of the people who were in later casts on Broadway?
Yes, please. Some of our replacements.
Yeah. Keith Carradine.
Yep.
Meatloaf.
Yep.
Mr. Loaf to you.
Mr. Loaf, if you are nasty.
Ben Vereen. Who is on the Tony performance.
Yes, with Heather McRae.
Yeah, who was a replacement. Joe Butler, Robin McNamara, Eddie Rambo. Like, incredible people in this original first run.
Mm-hmm.
And then a revival. So it closes.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Also, I want to say, speaking of yeah. Laurie Davis, Mel Blomer talked about how she got to play Sheila. Because she was with it for a while.
Yeah.
And what happened was I don't know if she was... No, she wasn't a replacement Sheila. She got to become an understudy for it.
Sure.
So what happened was that Diane went in almost immediately because Kellogg was like, I'm off making cereal.
Right.
And
Rice Krispies.
Yes, exactly. And when and when Diane left, they were auditioning women and Heather gets to do it. And they're auditioning for, I guess, like Heather's understudy. And Laurie Davis just says one day, she says very loudly, like, why are you not auditioning black women?
Yep.
And she says, which I love, and she points to Melba. She goes, Melba sings, Melba acts, why not ask Melba? She's like, you've got this fucking, you know, volcano of a voice here,
uh-huh.
singing three songs.
Yeah.
She could be Sheila. And so she, Melba auditions and gets to be the Sheila understudy. And again, in Hair, you never know when you're on. And
you're on.
Exactly. And I know in the original cast album, in the liner notes, they talk about how Diane was the best Sheila in terms of, like, the acting and the authenticity, mm-hmm. but that they all said, you haven't lived unless you've heard 22-year-old Melba Moore singing Easy to Be Hard.
I mean, and that I do listen to the Jennifer Hudson Easy to Be Hard a mm-hmm. lot because that is song.
It is her song.
She's like, I will get out my staple gun and put it to the wall. Let's go.
toot sweet.
Toot sweet, if you will. Yeah, it's just those arrangements are spectacular. And I think the trumpet is probably there because the Hare Krishna section,
mm-hmm.
which is because the trumpet is very much like has like a sort of revival sound to it in yeah. terms of I almost said like Christian music, but it's not Christian music. But you know what I mean? Yeah. Religious music.
Well, so when I asked my mom about what lasting impression has she had
yeah.
from that original production? And she said it didn't really feel like Broadway. It felt very rough and, mm-hmm. again, counterculture. But part of that was the idea that it all kind of felt a little improv. Like it, which yeah. obviously some things were, but there was a lot of stuff that was set, right? But it was about the feeling that this was all just sort of happening spontaneously. And I think the arrangements help with that because it doesn't sound like we are coming together to think of what sounds most rock, but rather like, we've got eight pieces here today. Like, what kind of sounds can we make with what we got
right.
today? Which is very of that culture of like the hippie culture of, I don't know, like we've got X, Y, Z. What kind of soup can we make with this?
Found items.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a bit of a randomness to the orchestrations that way, which I think makes it sound so great.
Fucking great. It's sort of like, Hair was sort of built the way Hedwig was built
mm-hmm.
in that it didn't exist. And it started at, like, nightclubs and whatever, and then became, like, a phenom
mm-hmm.
Just because.
Yeah.
Right?
The difference between Hare and Hedwig is that we have John Cameron Mitchell, who is, like, on another level brilliant.
Uh-huh.
And so with him, it was always just, like, and I'm not telling this to you. I know you know. I'm telling this to the listeners. Because
yes.
we have children who listen and don't know this. The years of workshopping Hedwig and all the clubs and whatnot was basically John meticulously knowing what works, writing new stuff, shaving it down, all this stuff. Whereas you have Rado and Ragni, literally shaving it down. And then you have Rado and Ragni who just come in and are like, we found this in the street. Let's make it a song. And McDermott's like, God damn it, I got to write another iconic melody right now.
He's like, oh, what is this lyric?
Yep.
It's another list.
Well, yeah, a lot of the lyrics, there are some songs in Hair, and we haven't really talked about a lot of the songs specifically yet.
We should.
Yeah. So, like, I'll use Frank Mills as an example, which is a brilliant use of melody because the lyrics don't rhyme. It's just a story.
Yeah.
It's a short story.
It's almost like a sort of Laura Nero-y, Carole King-y
little bit.
Folk ballad.
You know how Jody Benson always talks about Part of Your World? It's just a monologue set to pitch. That is literally Frank Mills, though. It's actually a monologue set to a melody.
100%.
I met a boy called Frank Mills on September 12th, right here in front of the Waverly. But unfortunately, I lost his address. He was last seen with his friend, a drummer he resembles George Harrison of the Beatles, but he wears his hair tied in a small bow at the back.
That's the thing about Hair, is that, like, even though it has aged, it is both aged and ageless.
Yeah. I think, though, there was a time where it came back too soon. So after the original production closed, like, 5 years later, they were like, what if? Mm-hmm. And Hair came back for 2 months because people were like, oh, we've moved past this. Mm-hmm. What is next? And it would almost be like, what year did Falsettos open?
92.
Say it runs for 4 years, closes, and they try to bring it back in 2000.
Yeah.
And we're sort of beyond that.
Yeah.
And it's not quite, or Rent.
No, it's
exactly
Rent.
Bringing back Rent. Yeah.
Which they did. They brought Rent back so soon after the Broadway production closed.
That
ended, and everyone was just like, the world has changed.
It was met with a shrug. Yeah. Now, in 20 years, somebody will bring back Rent as the time capsule of that very specific time, and it will be lauded. Mm-hmm. But
you need every show needs a breather.
Uh-huh.
And moment to be missed. And then come back with fresh eyes.
Which is why when the revival of Hair came back for that Summer of Love, it didn't do very well at the St. James. I saw it. I saw that cast, too.
Also, I don't know why they went in that theater. That was St. James is a very large theater. It's a very high theater.
Jude Jampson.
Yeah, I guess.
That's why.
So, Hair opens in 68 and it closes in 72.
Yep.
And 72 to 77, those 5 years... It's a huge difference in terms of just, like, the culture.
A huge shift in politics. Watergate has happened.
Watergate has happened, by 77, the Vietnam War is over.
Yeah.
And also, part of the reason why I feel like they brought it back was because with Hair, there was a feeling that, okay, Broadway has now embraced rock music, which was something that was eluding it for all of the 60s.
Right.
Hello, Dolly was the last Broadway cast album to go number one on the Billboard charts.
Right.
That nothing since then,
but Let the Sun Shine In, the Aquarius, the fifth dimension version of it, was the number one record.
Well, so Hair did sell really well, millions of copies, and covers of songs from the show,
which probably some producer was like, "What if they miss us?
Yeah,
they love us. Well, they want us back."
There was a hope that Hair would usher in an era of rock musicals.
Alas,
yes, and in fact, if you read the season, like one of the last notes of it, or maybe it's either that or the Joe Papuk. I can't remember which one, but no, it is. It is. I think it is the season where someone asks, like, "Do you think that Hair is going to change Broadway?" And the person in response says very cynically, of course it's going to change Broadway. We're now going to get a bunch of shitty rock musicals, which is always the case. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Hamilton opened and everyone was asking Sondheim, like, do you agree that Hamilton is groundbreaking? And Sondheim was like, it's been on Broadway for 3 months.
Yeah.
He's like, you can't say something is groundbreaking until you see the impact it has afterwards. He's like, let's give it a few years to see what it inspires, if anything changes with it.
Yeah.
He's like, I think it's great. I think it does a lot of really interesting stuff. he goes, you can't say groundbreaking until you see the overall impact. And in a way, Hamilton has had an impact, I would argue, often for the negative. Sure. The number of people who have described the Bruno revival of 1776 as a try-hard Hamilton. And ironically, they are. It is connected to Hair in the sense of not only just 1776 being the same season as Hair, but also both being directed by Diane Paulus.
And, oh, yeah.
And showing you sort of how all that goes. We're in Paulus' flop era. But
wait, do you know the other 1776 Hair connection? Mm-hmm. Betty Buckley did both.
She did. She was the original Martha Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was a singing voice in the movie version.
She sings Walking in Space.
Yes. She is lip-synced by an Asian actress.
She sure is.
And that is interesting.
Especially if you know Betty's voice.
Yeah, it's there.
It's she's holding those consonants like nothing I've ever seen.
Yeah. The movie version
is wild.
Yes. I've only seen clips. I'm a big Milos Forman stan. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a wonderful movie. And mm-hmm. as many people know, Amadeus is in my top three.
Sure.
Amadeus is probably the best adaptation of films from a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
Not musical, stage play. But, you know, Hair is a musical with no real plot. It's more about a vibe. And from what I understand, they tried to really give it a
plot. They really tried to give it a plot.
Yeah. But also, like, keep the vibe as well.
Yeah. But what's great about it is, like, there's Nell Carter. There's Laurie Beachman. Mm-hmm. Laurie Beachman does a full turn while keeping her eyes on the camera the whole time.
Andy Golden's in it, too.
Yes. And she withdrew from the revival to go make the film.
Part of... We were talking about this with the coming back too soon in the 70s.
Yeah.
It is the idea that rock musicals did not really happen. We got some musicals that incorporated some of the sound. Like, The Wiz had a lot of Motown flavor to it, but yes. still had Broadway
mm-hmm.
Spice. Chorus Line, a lot of that 70s groove, but again, Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And Hair was, like, not a Broadway sound.
No.
It was truly rock. And so it's like, oh, like, let's bring it back because no one has our sound. And everyone loves Hair anyway, right? It was such a big hit. It's like, well, yes, we missed the sound, but the show is not out of the moment.
It's dated.
And all the reviews at the time were like, it has shown its age. It's only been 5 years, but, like, my God, is it, you know, no longer of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, you know, 25 years until it finally came back with first Encores and then the Actors Fund and then
right. Because I don't think the Encores was good enough.
No.
I think that, and, like, Kathleen Marshall was not the right person.
No.
And she was the artistic director of Encores at the time, so it was her hiring herself to direct and choreograph it. And my God, did she choreograph it.
She sure did.
They are hullabalooing. They are...
Well, and Hair does need movement.
Yes.
And, like, if you watch the video of the 09 version, there is movement to it, but the this is why not all choreography is the same.
Right.
Everything has to adhere to the vibe of the show you're doing. It has to be based in character and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And the vibe of Hair is meant to feel like it's all happening on the spot.
Right.
Nothing is a bit. So you watch the choreography of that Paulus revival, and it's like it's choreographed, but it's not like... And
it's organically choreographed.
Exactly. It's not box step, kick, turn, blah, 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 blah.
No. And the Kathleen Marshall one truly looked like... like a TV variety show mm-hmm. was doing like a 60s theme.
Yeah, it was nostalgia.
Yeah, but not good nostalgia.
And also very clean. Like, everyone looks like they're in a Gap ad.
Sexy and clean. Yes, uh-huh. Because everybody's skinny.
Yeah.
Everybody's wildly skinny and like...
Ripped.
Ripped.
Yeah.
But then every so often, like a Kevin Cahoon or a... Miriam Shore breakthrough.
Yeah.
And Miriam Shore is brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, she was better than what she was handed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, like, the Paulus revival, there are also, you know, our skinny Broadway beautiful
uh-huh.
people. Like, that show.
But it also embraced size.
Yeah. There were other sizes as well. What I'm saying is that, like, I'm not saying – I don't want to make it sound like the Paulus version was
– perfect.
Yeah, and like on a pedestal of like inclusion of all different body types. There were body types that weren't just the Broadway ripped, but it is telling that like our three leads were Broadway toned.
Uh-huh.
Will Swenson showing a lot of skin, like being with like six-pack and the right amount of chest hair.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, Sex on a Stick, which was helpful. But
sure.
Like there was a reason why he launched from that production because – if he were schlubby looking, Mm-hmm. I don't think it would have happened for him.
Right.
Which is shitty to say, but it's honestly just the truth.
Sure.
Yeah, like, I mean, there was a tightness about that revival that I think made it palatable for a lot of modern audiences, but it's also the reason why my mom, like, walked out of the theater and the first thing she said was, I don't know, they were wearing costumes. The rest is silent.
I also feel like Diane Paulus of that time was vaguely a hippie. Like,
she's still a hippie.
Is she?
I mean, she's a hippie who's benefited from the system, so I'm sure there's a lot of, like, cynicism. Mm-hmm. My takeaway with a lot of people who are rich and successful and happen for a while is they, especially when their vibe when they got successful was I'm of the people.
Yeah.
Similar to RuPaul or Ellen DeGeneres. It's like, sure, you were once of us, but you have now been rich and successful so long, you're not really of the people anymore. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But you have to acknowledge that.
Like that, the Diane Paulus of Hair is the creator of The Donkey Show.
Yes, 1,000%.
The Diane Paulus of Jagged Little Pill is not the creator of The Donkey Show.
No. The Diane Paulus of Jagged Little Pill, 1776. That is the woman who made us Finding Neverland.
Yeah.
That is the woman who sold her soul to Weinstein. For...
She did give us a glitter tornado.
Someone asked once, say one nice thing about Finding Neverland. And I said, they made a good use of glitter.
Yep. I, as a longtime listener to the pod, have heard you rail.
I have railed Finding Neverland in a way that it should thank me afterwards.
Honestly, twinks have not been railed as hard as you in Finding
Neverland. I feng shuied Finding Neverland's guts. I fucked it so hard on this podcast. I have feng shuied Finding Neverland's guts. Whoopee, honey boo boo child. That show has made me into a dom top. Because I hate it so much, I want to stuff its face into a pillow.
You have to promise not to fall in love with me.
I promise. I'm so dead inside these days. Don't even worry. I don't have the capacity to love.
Well, I think maybe we should take a break.
Let's take a break.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar. You're the nimble.
Welcome back. So we haven't really talked about most of the songs. We did Frank Mills. But
sure.
Like, what's a song in Hair that you always gravitate towards?
I love Where Do I Go? I think it's a stunning. Oh, good. He is eating on the pod.
Finally, we had to do it.
It's tradition at this point.
Yep. But I will chew away while you talk.
Tradition, which is, of course, the Japanese song from Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm-hmm.
I love Where Do I Go? I think the melody of it's beautiful. The lyrics of it are stunning. I also love all the setting of Shakespeare that is used through the second half of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes Look Your Last and What a Piece of Work Is Man.
Which is that from Hamlet?
What a Piece of Work Is Man is directly from Hamlet.
Yeah.
Eyes Look Your Last is Romeo and Juliet, the scene where they're killing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And just that they're happening at all in a show that's essentially like drugs and sex and free love, like Shakespeare suddenly like appearing is it's like that highbrow metric that's on what is that, New York Magazine? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because like it shouldn't be there, but it works perfect, especially in the flesh failures. The eyes look your last, arms take your last embrace.
Yeah. I think what it does is there's this sort of stigma. Well, there's a stigma for everything, right? And so we think about, or at least I would say the audience would go into Hair thinking like, oh, these dumb hippies who just get high and don't have thoughts. It's like, oh no, actually half of them have read Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Like, the other thing about these hippies is, and the show kind of mentions this a bit, a lot of them come from like decent homes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of the hippie movement were people who benefited from the norm and from the man and kind of looked in the system and looked around and were like, I don't like any of this. Like, I benefit, but like, look at it. Was also a younger generation getting information about the rest of the world and how everything else worked in the world and going like, that's not okay. And like, why do I get to live in this comfort? That's weird. And sort of making us taking a stand against the system of America by going against the grain. And so people go into the theater and they're like, oh yeah, the dumb hippies. And it's like, well, actually, the dumb hippies are quoting Shakespeare.
Where do I go? Follow the children. Where do I go? Follow their smiles. Is there an answer in their sweet faces that tells me why I live and die? Follow the wind song. Follow the thunder. Follow the neon in young lovers' eyes down to the gutter.
What's really interesting about the score for me, too, is that while, like, the Folly score is a lot of pastiche, this is not pastiche. It is – it lives in the lane of, like, folk. Like, Electric Blues is basically a Mamas and Papas song. Don't Put It Down, Best One Around is, like, a full country western song. Frank Mills is a folk ballad. They all sort of commingle – and fell out of this guy's fingers, right, one day. Fascinating to me that he is so facile in every style he chooses to write in. And the vocal arranging, because the harmonies are tight.
Yeah.
Not that they're always sung tight.
Well, with that original cast, yeah.
Yeah. Let's just say that cast played fast and loose. With
I'm very pleased that we have both Gavin Creel and Will Swenson singing Going Down on record. Because Jerome Ragney, not the best vocalist in the world.
Sure.
And I love Going Down. I think that song is a fucking bop. This is my doom, my humiliation. Anyway.
Yeah. It's very, in some ways it's reminiscent it inspired like a lot of like Spring Awakening and stuff like that. Like, which is another rock musical in its way. It's just the doors that Hair has opened.
Hair and Gia Gunn opening all the doors.
It's just, they're the only two, honestly. In human hair.
There are four doors, and they are all opened by Gia Gunn and Hair.
And Gia Gunn in a 40-inch long wig.
Yep.
Of human hair.
She's feeling her oath. Let her feel her oath.
Let her feel my oath.
Let her feel my oath.
Okay. I'm feeling my oath.
Subtitles.
Let's talk about your listening habits for a second, because do you listen to playlists a lot, or do you listen to like shows front to back?
I go back and forth. I'm a faggot. So like,
I'm aware.
I know you're aware. You're literally staring at my bookshelf, but
that's what I'm staring at.
But so I'll go on the treadmill and I'll listen to pop music, but sometimes I'm like, you know what really does it for me is just like a boppy musical theater score with a structure to it.
Sure.
So like I will listen to
like a Hairspray or a Legally Blonde.
Absolutely. I'll also do the original chorus line.
Sure.
The opening, because especially when I'm starting on the treadmill and I have to run for a bit. It's a good way to begin, and then it gets you pumped. I'll also listen to my bootleg recording of In from Carrie, because that's just, it's 4.5 minutes of non-stop energy.
I'm well aware.
So it's, yeah, but like from like, if I'm like, I got 4 minutes left and I need to get half a mile out in these 4 minutes, I'm like, okay, in, here we go.
Someday, if I lasted long enough, and someday.
Yeah. Keep those bodies thin. I love it. So stupid.
She's,
so bonkers.
She's going to sing that in some pumps.
My God.
My gym teacher also wore pumps. I miss him.
And a white power suit. And I miss him. You know, we all looked like Charlotte Demoiselle in high school and did what she could do with that insane body with no spine.
I actually did. Then I got hungry.
And well, I got hungry. That's why I'm eating.
So hungry. Yeah.
But
an apple.
Which, like, with Hair. And if I'm at the gym and I'm listening to Hair,
yeah,
I honestly probably will listen to it all the way through if I'm not on the treadmill.
What is your favorite song of the score? The apple.
The apple of my eye.
Sure.
There's a lot. There's one I can't say the title of.
Really?
Can you say
3500?
No.
No, what?
I'll say it in cut it. Colored Spade.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the title of it. So I know, you can say that.
I know. I just makes it always makes me feel uncomfortable to
sure.
say it,
I mean, let's.
Which is the point.
But let's talk about that. Because, like, a lot of these songs are making points. Mm-hmm. And, like, he swung in on a rope and, like, lands in front of all these white people. And, again, like I said, the front half of the score is I Am songs.
Well. And I think Sodomy comes before that song.
Correct.
So the whole point of Sodomy is, it's a joke song, but then the whole point of the end of it is like, because he's listing sodomy, masturbation, blah, blah, blah.
While they're all in religious poses.
Yeah, and he's saying like, why do these words sound nasty? Is it because of the connotations to what they mean?
Uh-huh.
The words themselves are just words, and the actions themselves are not bad.
Right.
But, you know, America's a very puritanical country. So, yeah. And then it goes into...
And that's also a great rhyme, pederasty and nasty.
Mm-hmm. So good.
Into Colored Spade.
Yeah. Which is a list song
mm-hmm.
of all the slurs.
The pejoratives.
And, and stereotypes of black men.
Correct.
Shoeshine Boy, things like that. Elevator Operator.
And Shoeshine Boy comes back later in Abe Lincoln.
Yeah.
So. Shoeshine Boy. Yeah.
Elevator Operator, label cleaners, and honey.
And it's great music.
Great music. Yep. A bop. Also wonderful arrangements because those trumpets come in at the end
mm-hmm.
and they slide in. And similar to Sodomy, it's, you know, it's the list and it's sort of, it's both kind of calling out these words, these pejoratives, they don't really mean anything.
Yeah.
They're just attached to stigmas that you've put onto me.
Right.
And if I don't give them any clout, who the fuck cares? It's similar how
mm-hmm.
we in the queer community, like I literally just did 5 minutes ago, we take back words for ourselves. Like I take back the word faggot.
Sure.
Because If I give it less power, anytime mm-hmm. someone throws it at me, I'm like, okay, go fuck yourself. What do I care? Like,
mm-hmm.
okay, yes, I am a gay man. Anything else? Like, what else you got, bitch?
Truly.
Like, what? Truly. Like, yeah, I'm like, what else is in your wheel? What is in your armory? Like, I don't fucking care. So,
do better.
Do better with your vocabulary, baby. How about you be a little more specific and find something that really hurts my feelings? Like, John Mulaney has that bit. Where he talks about how teenagers are really good at insults because they actually find something specific uh-huh. and they go, that man's got feminine hips. Stop it. I'm sensitive about that. That's sort of me.
I do have feminine hips.
Yes. Oh, he clearly drinks coffee. His teeth are less white than 3 weeks ago. I know. Stop it. Watermelon, omnigreens, and shortening bread, alligator ribs, some pigtails, some black eyed peas, some chili. If there's like one song that I probably listen to the most, I don't, you know what it is? It's on the original cast recording, it is like the very first five songs, like in a row.
Aquarius into
Donna.
Donna into Sodomy.
Yeah.
Into Colored Spade.
What is it?
And Manchester?
It's Aquarius, Donna, Hashish, Sodomy.
Oh, Hashish.
Colored Spade, Manchester, England. Those first six.
Yeah.
It's for me. It's like one big old short story, like one act play.
And what's your skip song on the album?
Because here's the thing, like I don't skip "I'm Black" because it goes right into "Ain't Got No," which mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with.
God, that, can I tell you, as an actor, mm-hmm. hardest lyrics I've ever had to learn in my life.
It's, well, "Ain't Got No."
They're just
reprise.
Nonsense.
Reprise into air,
like that
nonsense, and there's no order
like that.
To it.
A bombs, H bombs, B bombs, Q bombs, Chinese checks, Indus, Vintus, Italianos, Pollocks, Germans, use, Jews, ups and downs,
and then
right, and you're like shit. Pop up, pop off, popcorn, popsicle.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's
you have no skip songs.
I don't think I have a skip song. Yeah, no, every fucking song. I'm just like, fuck me. Like, fuck me sideways. So good.
Mm-hmm.
Baby Baby is one where, like, that's a long game. Because you have to wait for Laurie Davis to come in.
100%.
And then it stops being a skip. Like, if you don't know the song
mm-hmm.
and you're impatient, you listen to the first 40 seconds, you're like, Okay. But then she becomes in, and then they got the happy birthday, baby, happy birthday to you.
Bang. Bang. Yeah. Perfect.
Oh, you know what? It is? The bed. But that's not really
so in the show. Interesting. It's in some productions. And that's what I mean by it's like chess. Because yeah. It comes, it goes. Things you can do in bed. It's another fucking list song, right? Yeah. But this one's about a bed. And it's only because they had one that was built for the off-Broadway production where there were two other songs. One was called Climax. And the other one's name is too long and I can't remember it.
Yeah.
But it's on the off-Broadway album.
And I think it's...
It's just
when they do it.
It's a how come?
Yeah, and when they did it in the Broadway version, it was covering when Sheila and Claude get together.
Yeah, I mean that's what it was actually written to be.
Yeah,
but it's also like a.
It wasn't in the revival. The bed wasn't in the revival. Yeah, it's not.
It's a very talk about a skip song.
Yeah, yeah, the one skip song, and it comes right before Flesh Failures Let the Sunshine In, which so it's sort of like there's that quote on the nanny. Going back to like LP records, and you know they talk about Streisand and Funny Girl all the time, and, and Fran Drescher says, "So you gotta listen, you gotta get through Henry Street if you want to make it to people."
Correct, and, not wrong,
not wrong. But you just you know that you're in for a bad one when it goes the bed, and you're like, oh god. But everything else, yeah, no skips, love it so dearly.
Yeah, yeah. It's just excellent writing. It's also very interesting to me that these writers wrote a phenomenon and never managed to recapture that.
Galt McDermott got the closest with Two Gentlemen, but that wasn't even a phenomenon. That was just popular for a moment.
Yeah, a moment.
Yeah, and I don't think his score for Two Gentlemen is nearly as good as here.
It's not.
The only one I like is Night Letter. So divine.
Everybody likes Night Letter.
But only when Miss Renee does it.
I mean, yes.
Speaking of Kathleen Marshall, but...
Speaking of the park.
Speaking of the park.
Yeah.
Hair in the park, Two Gentlemen in the park.
God, there was just must be something so magical about sitting under the stars as hair is unfolding.
Yeah. And I know on opening night, it rained when they started doing Let the Sunshine In. And everyone's like, you couldn't buy a better, you know, symmetry.
Diane did a concert version of The Cape Man in the Park.
Sure did.
That I wish I had seen.
I heard it was garbage.
Oh, Natasha was the lead.
Miss Diaz?
Yeah.
I know she did it on Broadway. I didn't know she did it.
Yeah, no, but she they bumped her up, and she was the mother.
I don't know what it was like for the cast. I know a few people who saw it who did not care for it.
I see.
Because I know that it was they reworked it a bit.
A lot.
Yeah, and the idea was if this works, we'll go.
We're going to move it.
Yeah.
Like hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
No.
Same thing.
I saw the original production on Broadway, and that definitely did not work. No. So.
And that had a Bob Crowley set design.
Mm-hmm. That set was something.
Yeah, a lot of, yeah. That his sets are usually something.
No, but like everything that you saw on stage was replicated in a drop, so that it was like you were looking at it from two angles at the same time, and then like a full scale like relief map of Puerto Rico came in, and she just sat on it singing a lullaby to her two children, on full cities and houses.
Listen, if Alice Ripley can feel the shadow orgasms of Emily Skinner's finger blasts, why not this?
Whomst among us hasn't?
Who has not felt the shadow orgasms of Emily Skinner?
While she's like screaming.
Well, they're both screaming. Yeah. Listen, I'd be screaming an F2 if I wasn't getting mine.
I want mine.
Where is mine?
Okay.
Yeah. So, hair.
Yes.
If someone's doing hair.
Yes.
What are some things they should keep in mind when they're attacking this material?
Oh. That's it. So what I've always found interesting is like the people who do hair all tend to fall in love with each other very quickly because they suddenly cease to be actors and become like the tribe. You know what I mean? Like there are sleepovers. There's like it's almost unhealthy in a way.
Actors being unhealthy, you don't say.
Never heard of it. But like. Like, they were sleeping over in the theater at the Biltmore. Like, shit like that. They were a family, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't a job, even though, clearly, because they weren't showing up.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a job to them. And then, like, the last revival, like, that's what started Broadway for Equality, where, like, they literally marched in Washington and, like, were very passionate about causes that are important to you and I, the gays.
It was also the show that made Gavin Creel come out publicly.
And good.
Yeah. And he did it ever so drop the mic-y of just being on the steps with Jonathan Groff.
Like, who?
Yeah.
Frankly, one would watch. Two,
I don't know if I'd watch.
Would I? Did anybody need flashcards? Is the question. But good that he did.
Yeah.
And he led a movement.
He did.
He and Rory O'Malley.
I mean, he moved me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. What I did to Finding Neverland's guts.
Great.
Could happened to me.
It was in a gym sauna. Subscribe.
Let's not
to
talk
Matt
about
Complex OnlyFans.
Let's not talk about Bub, shall we?
It's actually called Only Flans because he bakes on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
so
God.
The question is, what should they keep?
Yeah.
I would say to not be too pretty with it. It is not a pretty story, and they are not songs to be sung prettily.
Yeah.
It's more about intention. You should do the Robbie Roselle style of singing, which is acting.
Ah.
In that.
So not singing.
Yeah, correct. No. I do have a hit album. Please stream it.
Anytime you go, guys, if you ever go out in public with Robbie Roselle, yeah. And I don't mean like, oh, like going out to like a show. I mean like literally any place in this world, and you're standing next to Robbie Roselle for more than 30 minutes. How many times will he tell people he has an album? And the truth is, it works because you have a good number of streams.
I do.
So he does guerrilla marketing.
I'm about to hit a million, which is very weird because I'm not famous.
I mean, I got you on this podcast, so clearly you've got to be somebody.
I had no time, so I carved out a day. I skipped the piano lesson to be here today.
You're very welcome.
But Dr. Rashad is doing a talk back after.
Okay.
Anyway, it's true. Like, Matt and I will go to the old glass house or something, and if somebody will walk by and say something weird and loud, I will just be like, thank you so much for my album. Mm-hmm.
I will also literally grab people's phones and make them give me 5 stars on the podcast.
Good. Yeah. Honestly, anything that works. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we do what we got to do.
We deserve.
I deserve everything in this world.
If you were directing hair,
yes.
What would you give your actors for preparation? As like, here's sort of your vision board.
I would probably find like news reels and whatnot and TV segments just to give like an actual visual to it. And
yeah,
obviously photos and things like that. I would, I don't know, like I'm not super boned up on the films of that era. A lot of because a lot of the films of the 60s weren't really covering that movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I could say is, you know, find like 3 or 4 films of that decade that were very pivotal for that generation. So like Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate.
Yeah.
And like, actually, you know, like giving like a 5-minute clip of Ben-Hur from 1959 and then being like, and then 6 years later we have Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, Midnight Cowboy. Like,
yeah.
Imagine being 10 years old and having to deal with Ben-Hur. 4 hours of fucking Charlton Heston's bullshit.
Why not?
And then finally, like when you're a teenager, like these really huge movies that change everything come into your life, and like that affects you in a really specific kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would show that, and just to give the impact of ever changing minds and innocence and expansion, but also like with that group in hair, sometimes it feels like there's a little bit of misused energy of the tribe,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of I think what makes Claude's story compelling. Even if we don't agree with his choice, even if we're not entirely sure why he makes the choice,
mm-hmm.
he does ultimately make a choice. As one man with a dungeon used to say, I chose and my world was shaken, so what? The choice may have been mistaken, the choosing was not. And that's sort of Claude's thing, is like, no one in the show makes a choice.
No.
They're empathetic, and they're knowledgeable to an extent, and they protest, but they don't really do anything else. And something that's always sort of nagging Claude, it's why he's the only one we get like flashbacks of from his family,
mm-hmm.
of just the constant reminder of, what are you even doing? Like, sure, you're against this, but like, what are you for? And what are you going to do to change anything?
Yeah.
And ultimately, his answer is to go to war. It may not be the right answer, but it is an answer. And I think that's something to remind the cast of, like, these are a bunch of people who have all the feelings and all the right thoughts, but have absolutely no idea what to do with any of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's just, that's why I said he feels like an outsider looking in.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how to become this.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, like Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote, you've got to be carefully taught, right? And so you behave how your parents, et cetera, teach you. And so Claude was probably brought up to, like, you respect the president, you respect America, mm-hmm. America first, whatever, like, whatever that was at that time. And so, yes, you will go to fight for your country just like your dad did in World War II, or, you know, yeah. 100%. That is a fascinating dichotomy to sort of unravel, mm-hmm. especially in a 2-hour musical review.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What do you think Hair changed?
In terms of theater or the world?
Let's start micro and say theater.
Sure. I think Hair was another step forward for the concept musical.
Uh-huh.
Because we had Cabaret.
Yes.
Which was...
We had Love Life and then...
Yeah, Love Life, yes. And Lady in the Dark. Well,
sure.
Shows where the concept dictated the writing.
Mm-hmm.
So... They still had stories. Love Life was, you know, reviews, but still, like, right. there were stories. There was plot to be followed, but it was dictated by a certain structure that came from an idea. Lady in the Dark, only singing during dream sequences, and it's all the dream sequences come from therapy sessions.
Right.
Cabaret, you know, songs in limbo, songs in the cabaret, songs in real life, but still a plot, two different plots.
Yeah, like a full-ass plot.
Yeah. Hair has, like... almost no plot. It's really just the Claude thing, and even that is thin.
Yeah, I mean, there's like Sheila got a shirt, and Berger rips it.
Yeah,
and
a lot of other characters have things we learn about them that don't come to anything.
Right, like I'm in love with Mick Jagger. Yeah. How nice.
But which also kind of leans into the idea of, you know, these kids with a lot of ideas and a lot of poetry that don't do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we learn about all these characters and like it's and for what? It's like, yeah, well. What's any of it for?
Right.
So it is a concept in that sense of not a lot happens, and it's more about the vibes and the music, which leads us into Company and Follies and shows like that, where it's more about the feeling you
like
get.
A mood.
Yes, it's a mood, exactly. The obviousness of rock music.
So what do you consider the heir apparent to Hair?
In terms of...
like musically, is it Rent?
Probably in terms of channeling the sound of that era
mm-hmm.
into a musical theater score.
Yeah.
The difference is that Rent uses a lot of different genres, whereas Hair uses other genres. But I mean, like, Rent uses also some classical music. It uses some musical theater elements. And
mm-hmm.
Rent also tries to put all of that into a musical theater structure, whereas Hair couldn't give two shits.
Right.
But yeah, I guess Rent is the closest heir apparent. I don't think there's really been a show like Hair since in terms of...
That worked,
yeah. Uh-huh. In terms of channeling the sound of the moment, not really having much of a musical theater structure, just sort of being a vibe,
mm-hmm.
Which is also kind of what makes it evergreen is because there's not much else like it that works. If there were 10 other shows like it that came since that went even further and stronger and bolder and better,
mm-hmm.
Hair would not be as... you know, played today.
I mean, that's the next question is, why do you think it's endured?
I think it's endured, A, because of the music. Music, I cannot underestimate how important good music is.
So wildly listenable.
Yeah. And I think in a weird way, because it is a bit of a blank canvas of storytelling,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot you can project onto it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When something's not really giving you specifics, it's the Bella Swan syndrome of Bella Swan in Twilight is written so blandly
mm-hmm.
with so little detail about her.
Yeah.
Every young woman in America who read it could picture herself.
100%.
Same thing with, you know, not to drag them too much, but why I'm kind of post Evan Hansen, I've been a little anti Pasquin Paul as I have found their writing to become more general.
Mm.
The lyrics are not as specific as they used to be.
Sure.
And so like things like This Is Me, like, yeah, of course that became an international phenomenon. It doesn't mean anything. It's tea bag metaphors put on a billboard with glitter.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's like, ha ha, it me. And I'm like, yes, when you say, I'm a person with arms and legs and I have a mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you may, like, you know, cut off 0.05% of the population, but the rest of the world is like, yes, that's me.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's like there's specificity to the songs, but the vibe of hair is still rather general.
Yeah.
I think 100%. That helps a lot.
Yeah.
Keeping it malleable, you can shapeshift it as the times continue. Why do you think it survived?
I think that Cast album, and it having so many hit songs fly out from it,
sure,
really kept it in the zeitgeist. And also the nude scene for how brief it was, whatever, kept people talking about it, because like we knew Hair probably as the nude musical, even though it was fleeting, right?
Yeah,
that was like one of the first things we ever heard about when we talked about musicals with anybody. Well, oh, what's this musical, Hair? Oh, there was a nude scene. Mm-hmm. Right. And so because that was the first of its kind in that way, it is and sort of the mythos built around it. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, what has really kept it afloat. But that Cast album being as good as it is truly what keeps people coming back to it and returning to the well.
You're actually really right about the nude scene, because that's always been something that stuck with it. Mm-hmm. There's an episode of Cheers where Woody Harrelson's character is doing a production of Hair. And because he's an aspiring actor now,
sure,
and he doesn't know really anything about it. And Christie Alley's like, oh, like, are you nervous about the nude scene? He's like, yeah, sure. Stop, you know, pulling my chain. She's like, no, I did Hair in college. Like, there's a nude scene.
Yeah.
And Woody, like, freaks out. He looks at the script and he sees that it's there. He's like, oh, God. And then everybody's all up in arms like, oh, Christie Alley, you went nude in college? She's like, I don't know. I was in Hair. It's fine. And
yeah.
And so that's something that's always attached to it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
What was so interesting is there's a lot of other shows that had even more nudity than Hair,
yes,
that never really, I don't know, we don't like really apply it to those shows. Like, I literally just covered Love, Valor, Compassion, and I know at the time the male nudity in it was like a big thing about it,
sure,
but when we talk about that show now, it's not something that's at the forefront of people's minds.
No, because it like that barrier had been broken.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. That hymen was broken.
The hymen was broken, darling. But yeah, I think because Hair was, and Hair wasn't the first show to have nudity on stage, but I think it was the first show to have male nudity. Maybe?
Yes.
And definitely en masse.
Uh-huh.
And in a musical.
Yes. In a musical.
Yeah.
That's like the biggest thing. I remember a couple, maybe a decade ago now, I was in London and I saw a musical version of Mrs. Henderson Presents. Did you see that film?
Yeah, I saw the film.
Yeah. Which is all about nudity.
Yeah.
And on stage, specifically. And I didn't know that going in.
Yeah.
I had not seen the film. And it was a fine musical. Tracy Bennett, sure.
Sure.
But I was like, okay. What ground are you breaking?
None.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a part of the story, if it works, then it works. But
mm-hmm.
There's so little I find that's like shocking anymore. So I'm more like, keep me invested in what's going on stage.
Right.
Don't worry about shocking me. I'll find something shocking because of how it relates to the plot, you know, but or the character.
Every review mentioned the nude scene, and they mentioned Tama Horgan. They rarely talked about the cast.
Rarely, yeah.
And if they did, they talked about it as a mass.
I mean, that happens a lot with these shows where it's ensemble based and the show itself is so groundbreaking in what it's mm-hmm. doing. So like if you read the original reviews of West Side Story that are rather complimentary,
mm-hmm.
no one really talks about the actors all that much.
Right.
It's sort of like, yeah, like so-and-so was pretty good.
Jerome Robbins did this.
Yes. Cheetah gets a couple of mentions, but it's mostly for her dancing. Carol mm-hmm. Lawrence is, you know, given a mention as like one of the better singers in the cast, but still not great. Everyone's just like, it's not about the actors. It's about what the team has done.
Right.
And that's definitely the vibe with Hair as well.
Mm-hmm. Because it's not a star vehicle or a star-driven vehicle.
Yeah.
And it was like truly a bunch of noobs.
Yeah.
Some
of whom went on to great success, some of whom never did.
Truly. Like Merrily. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And but, like, I'm trying to think of, like, another fully ensemble musical where there's not a lead, per se. Mm-hmm. And but Hair is, like, it's we can talk about it and have at great length. But, like, the average person isn't like, oh, God, Melba Moore, am I right? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
It's just the tribe of mm-hmm. the American Tribe of Love rock musical.
Yeah. I will say with the revival, and I kind of think that points to how our Broadway fandom culture has changed. When I know when the revival came out, it definitely became about like picking out tribe members that people liked.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that was not like Will Swenson definitely like launched from that. That brought Gavin Creel to a new level because he had been away for a while.
Same thing with Casey.
Casey Levy, yeah. And then Allison Case, that was like a big thing for her.
Mm-hmm.
Not Patina Miller.
But
God, what's her face?
I mean, Patina did it in the park.
She did it in the park. But Sasha Allen.
Sasha Allen, like, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People started having, fans of the show started having like their favorite tribe members and their own fandoms. And I don't think that's
social media didn't exist.
I know. I'm saying it's not. I don't think that's a statement on the revival so much as it's a statement on where we got to.
Yeah.
And I wonder if when Hair came out, if we had a kind of social media, mm-hmm. if that would have happened, or if.
I mean, there were like Hair groupies.
Yeah, and I know that
some of them like apparently snuck on stage in the nude scene sometimes and stuff.
Yeah. Well, there all the audience interaction and sort of the whole go with the vibe. Mm-hmm. Flow of it, I'm sure it was very easy to do so, and whatever. In the revival, no one snuck on stage to get nude, but you were allowed to go on stage and dance at the
end. And they would live stream the dance party mm-hmm. on Facebook nightly.
Yeah,
which was a good marketing ploy.
It made you feel included, and it ran for over a year.
Uh huh. Came back for the Summer of Love.
Summer of Love. I also remember when it was closing, the fandom was like took to Times Square to try to save it, and I was like. Guys, sometimes shows just close. And, like, this revival ran for over a year. That's great. Revivals don't usually run that long.
Correct.
They'll usually do really well for about 4 or 5 months. Business will start to slip, and then they close up shop before they lose any more.
Mm-hmm.
To run over 500 performances is amazing.
Yeah.
Let it be what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Let it be the be-in.
It's also just interesting to see, like, because that last cast launched, a lot of people mm-hmm. have come out of that last cast and gone on to, like, really wonderful things. I would love to know what like the next iteration of Hair, who that would be mm-hmm. and what it would launch, because like now I'm thinking about like Bonnie Milligan and Hair.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah,
but she's a star now, you know what
she,
I mean,
she is a star now.
She'll win a Tony this year,
I'm pretty sure of it.
Yeah,
she's definitely the front runner.
Uh-huh.
We are recording this in early January.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's going to go down.
You've just watched Christmas in the Square.
I have.
But.
I feel very confident saying that Bonnie is a lock for a nomination.
Yes.
Currently the front runner to win.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously anything can happen. I'm sure they're going to add like a 3-hour ballad for Ruthie Ann Miles and Sweeney. And that all of a sudden the Beggar Woman becomes the Tony winning role. But
Bonnie Milligan is on my hit debut album.
Sure she is.
Thank you.
She sure is. Robbie.
Yes.
This has been lovely.
This is amazing.
This has been wonderful. I think we're at a good spot.
Yeah.
Before we start truly trailing off and going into Jennifer Lewis's and Christine Baranski's careers.
Uh-huh.
As you know,
uh-huh.
we've got a game.
Yeah.
Same game, different titles.
Yep. Sure have not. I actually did not prep for this.
Neither did I. Who Lives, Who Dies, Janine DeSori. And... And 6 degrees of Sally Murphy.
Sure.
They are both just 6 degrees mm-hmm. of both women. Now, we have to go with the original production of Hair. I'm so sorry. Which means we have the original cast, the original creative team, and we have to connect it to both Janine DeSori and Sally Murphy. I will start with Tom O'Horgan directing. Because uh-huh. we can't do replacements either.
Sure.
Tom O'Horgan directing.
Uh-huh.
Directed the original Jesus Christ Superstar.
Sure.
Which had, let's go with Ben Vereen. He's famous. So Tom O'Horgan into Jesus Christ Superstar with Ben Vereen. Ben Vereen did Pippin
mm-hmm.
with,
fuck.
Careful how we tread now. Okay, Anne Rankin. She was in the ensemble of Pippin.
So yes. Three. Uh-huh.
Anne Rankin.
Sure.
She started and choreographed in the revival of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
So that's 4.
Yes. We have to get you to Sori or to Sally Murphy.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to get there. This is going to be difficult. I might have to go back. I'm going to go back. I'm going back. Okay.
Sure.
We're going to try this again.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ.
Superstar.
God damn it. Okay.
Sori.
Or Sally.
Right.
Yeah.
But Sori's the easier one.
Sure.
Because There's so many musicals.
Yeah.
Okay. And Ben Vereen's been in so many things. Or, like, no, because I can't be like, Shelley Plimpton gave birth to Martha.
Okay. You know what? I've got a deep dive.
Go.
This is going to get me to Sally.
Okay. And you've never been to Sally, but you've been to you.
Yeah. Galt McDermott is the composer of Hair.
Yes.
He also composed Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Yes.
Stocker Channing is in the original cast of Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Wow.
It's one of those random things that I just know.
Uh-huh.
Stocker Channing was in the revival of Pal Joey.
Yes.
Directed by Joe Mantello.
Uh-huh.
Who directed the off-Broadway production of Man of No Importance with Sally Murphy. There we go. Bada bing, bada boom. That's 6 degrees of Sally Murphy.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. Janine Tesori, though. I don't know.
Shit.
Yeah, this is going to be hard. And not in a good way. Not in a way that Gavin Creel can be here right now.
Listener, he's sweating a little.
Just a little.
Okay, wait. So we have to get to Tesori. Yeah. I'm trying to reverse engineer this in some way.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about... Okay, maybe...
Who is in that Twelfth Night that Tesori wrote the...
Who is in it?
Yeah.
Movie stars Paul Rudd, Helen Hunt, Philip Bosco, I believe. Kira Sedgwick. Ooh, okay, wait, hold on.
Uh-huh.
I think we can get something. What? What you got?
Hair.
Yes.
Fuck, what's her name?
Mm-hmm.
Annie Golden.
Okay.
Violet. Janine Tesori.
But Annie Golden didn't do the original production of Hair.
Fuck, no, but she did the film.
She did do the film. Well, so can we do...
Or what's another... How do we get to Annie Golden?
Now I'm trying to get to...
Great question.
Okay. Is there a Michael Bennett connection to Hair in any way? That's where I'm kind of coming at.
Great question. I don't think so, because most of them were not trained anythings.
I know, but I have a feeling... At the very least, you know what? You know what we can do?
Tell me.
Because we can include production teams.
Uh-huh.
The original production of Hair.
Yes.
Had a set design by Robin Wagner.
Yes.
One of his earliest set designs.
Uh-huh.
He designed Coraline and Dreamgirls.
Yes.
But we're going to go with Dreamgirls.
Okay.
Designed Dreamgirls.
Yes.
Starring Cheryl Lee Ralph.
Sure.
Who was in Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Sure
written
was.
By Janine Tesori.
Oh.
Damn.
Wow. You did it, Joe.
We did it, Joe.
No, you did it. I'm nobody.
No, that's amazing. I am so proud of myself.
That was really hard.
Yes. Gavin just left. That was really hard.
Bye,
anyway.
Gav.
Bye, Gav. Me.
Do you know that his home is called Hackle House?
No. Yeah. Does he heckles people?
No, Hackle.
Well, Hackle. Why Hackle?
Cornelius.
Oh, because he bought it with his Hello Dolly money?
Yep.
That'll do it.
There's like a shingle hanging outside of it that says Hackle House.
Like an upstate home?
Yeah. He lives next door to Patty Murin and Colin Donnell.
That'll do it. Anywho, Robbie, where can people find you if you want them to find you?
I'm so wildly findable at Diva Robbie, which was my AOL screen name when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a cautionary fable in branding. Choose wisely, kids.
Gypsy, a musical cautionary fable.
Because it can stick.
Yes.
I'm findable. I'm very streamable on the Spotify's.
Mm-hmm.
For my semi-hit album, Songs from Inside My Locker, live at Fine Signs 54 Below.
Songs from Inside My Locker.
Yeah, it's a good. It's fun.
It's a fun time.
Yeah,
it's a fun time.
Actually, the last time I was on the pod, we were fundraising for it. So
look how far you've come, baby.
Yeah,
it's all here. It's all happening.
You lost 130 pounds, and his name was John.
140. Come on, he's
That's
tall.
True.
He's
he tall. Is tall.
He is very tall.
I love him so much.
actually, he and I are supposed to get dinner soon. I have to actually set a date for that.
Well,
thank you for reminding me. Love you, baby. If you guys like the pod, rate, review, subscribe.
Five stars.
Give us a nice little rating. I read a lovely one for the Love Ballad Compassion episode. You can find me at Matt Koplik, usual spelling on Instagram and Instagram only.
Yep.
Check back next week for I don't know what, because this whole thing is out of order and it's a whole thing.
It's a lot of stuff. Like, you threw me like 10 titles.
I know. And that is saying something, because I have already had half of the shows covered. So
it's wild.
Yeah. Getting us through, at least through the Tonys.
God bless.
You got to do something.
You're truly doing the Lord's contracts work.
I will punch you. So I'm trying to think who we should have close us out. I think we got to go with the diva herself, Miss Melba Moore.
Yeah, do yeah, it.
Got to do it. Yeah. All right.
She got love.
She got so much love. You know, I saw her as Fantina Les Mis.
There was also another like Jennifer Hudson, Melba Moore crossover because Jennifer sang I Got Love on mm-hmm. Smosh.
She sure did.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's gorge all around.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful.
What a time to be alive.
What a wonderful time to
you
look around.
You saw her in Les Mis?
I saw her in Les Mis, yeah. Oh she, I was 5 years old. My parents took me to see Les Mis when I was five.
They said, what about this nap?
Mm-hmm. I was awake the entire time. But I remember seeing Melba. It was a time. But yeah. So anyway, join us back next week, guys, for God Knows What. And until then, enjoy Miss Moore if you're nasty. Take us away, Melbs. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.